objectivity and neutrality is actually a tenet of white supremacy, and we cannot be neutral, right? So we have to make sure that we are not telling our students what to think, but we have to teach them how to think, right? We have to teach them to be critical thinkers. And so how do we do that?
Hola, hola, it's Gabby Acosta.
And me, Janelle Acosta. We're high school sweethearts on a journey to be better allies.
You're listening to The Way We Lead, where we talk about inclusive leadership, allyship, and advocacy with folks across identities, industries, and experiences.
If you're new here, welcome. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter using the handle at The Way We Lead.
We're glad you're here. Let's jump in.
Hi, folks. My name is Katy Lebron, and I am a proud radical Dominicana. I was born and raised in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm an anti-racist and culturally responsive educator and consultant. And I'm a mother-to-be, currently dreaming about reimagining motherhood and parenting for liberation and what that can look like.
Yes. And you're a fellow Smithy.
Yes, I am. Class of 2012.
I feel like I'm just going through Smithies right now. Like, I'm just finding all the Smithies, and they're all phenomenal social justice, like, warriors in some way, shape, or form. So I'm like,
that's what you all were bred to do in that school, though. So it makes a lot of sense that that's really basically where we're getting our main clientele.
They're fucking awesome. Yes.
Yeah, they're pretty freaking great.
So to follow up a little bit on your background, you're doing sort of anti-racism work and training for elementary school teachers and trying to incorporate that. Were you a school teacher before?
Yes. So during my senior year at Smith, I was recruited for Teach for America. And like prior to that, I'd never really seen myself as an educator. I didn't think that I was going to go into education, but I did. Luckily, I was recruited, and I actually ended up at a school in Washington Heights in New York City. Which was great. I was there for 5 years. And so I was teaching throughout, but it wasn't until my final year there that I became like a social action teacher and a school culture coach. And so that, like, really my primary role was to sort of develop this social justice curriculum that was like culturally responsive and anti-racist. And that's like what I was teaching, which was awesome. Yeah.
And is that a pretty unique role to where you were? Like, have you heard of other folks having that specific role in other schools?
Yeah, so that was something that in collaboration with the principal, we sort of like talked about it. In my work at the school, like before that, I had started a social justice committee. We had like done trainings and professional developments. I was also like the coordinator for our restorative justice initiative. So I was like doing sort of this work, but it wasn't like my sole work, right? Like it wasn't like the sole scope of my work. I was teaching. And so during that final year, I was kind of like thinking about like, well, you know, what would it look like to be sort of like a, you know, other schools have more traditional deans of culture, but really those roles are like, they're more about like behavior management, right? Not necessarily thinking about school culture in the sense of like, how do we make our school culture more culturally responsive? How do we make our pedagogy, our curriculum, right? Like everything about our school more culturally responsive and anti-racist, and like, how do we develop these practices? And so we sort of like twisted it in the sense of like, okay, well, it could be something like a dean of culture or school or like a school culture coach, but really focusing it around like social justice and around like all these different themes, not just like for the teachers, but like for the students.
Can you give a couple examples of what that looks like in practice? Like what kinds of, break that down. Like you're talking about social justice curriculum. You're also talking about weaving in culturally restorative justice into your work. So what does that mean for folks who don't know? And then also how do you bring that down to earth for teachers and for students?
Yes. So I would say that it kind of started a few years prior, right? Like with the social justice committee. So I had instances, you know, I had students who, I had this one student, we were celebrating Black History Month, and he came up to me and he was like, hey, Ms. LeBron, like, I just like wonder why all of, like a lot of the characters in the books that we read, they don't look like me. And like, that sort of stopped me dead in my tracks. And I was just like, oh man, like we're failing our kids if they don't see themselves represented in the books that we're reading, if they don't see themselves represented, you know, in our walls, like just on our walls, like the you know, the sort of the people that we're putting on our walls,
right,
the quotes, the characters, right? Like if they don't see themselves represented, like we're failing them. And so from then on, I sort of like started thinking about, well, like, what can we do to, as a school, not just like as an individual educator, right? Because you as an individual educator, you can change things and you can do things in your classroom, but that doesn't necessarily mean, right, that that's going to have an impact on the school overall, right? And so how do we as a school really reflect on our practices when we think about like behavior management, when we think about like who's getting suspended and who's not, when we think about, oh, like our school curriculum, our lessons, when we think about our community meetings, we had like sort of like daily community meetings for different grades. And so like, just like thinking about everything overall, school culture, like how do we make sure that our students feel represented, that they feel valued, that they feel seen, that they feel affirmed, right? And how do we also reflect on our practices as educators? Like, just like the relationships amongst ourselves, right? The relationships we have with families and the relationships we have with our students. And so in thinking about all of that, you know, we sort of started this like social justice committee with a group of teachers, and we started to think about race and power and privilege. And we started to have these like really honest conversations amongst ourselves. We had like book clubs, we read articles that we would reflect on. And then we started to develop professional development. So PD for our teachers. And so we had like sort of PDs on like power and privilege, anti-blackness, right? Like things like that. And then it wasn't until like that final year, that fifth year, where we actually, a group of us, became sort of like a restorative justice committee. And so we were trained for like a week. We went to Pennsylvania and we had this training, and we learned about restorative justice and restorative practices and how we would implement them at our school. Wow. And so restorative justice, for folks who don't know really what that is basically, it's an alternative to traditional punitive methods of behavior management, right? Like you're really thinking about like, what was the harm that was caused, right? And then you're thinking about like, how do we address that harm and how do we repair the relationships while really focusing on like the person that was harmed, right? Yeah. And making sure that you're like leading by their example and like whatever their needs are, you're sort of like thinking about, okay, how do we repair the harm in a way that like really make sure that their needs aren't being met?
It's interesting that you bring up restorative justice in that way, because it was a big part of some of the work that my parents were doing when I was growing up. They would work on restorative justice in the application in Civil War recovery. So back in El Salvador, there was Civil War is particularly painful because it literally is pinning like family against family, right? It's like your blood fighting against itself. And so there's still a lot that's been over 30 years now that the war has ended, and yet people are still really struggling with the repercussions and generational impact of what happened. And restorative justice is a huge way that people can think about how do we tell the stories in a way that both sides can be empowered to share their perspective and then heal together, rather than like say, well, you wronged me, so you owe me this, right? Like it's more of a, how do we move forward together? And that's always been a really fascinating perspective, especially in anti-racism work, because it brings up the question of, you know, your ancestors did something that hurt my ancestors, and that still hurts today and has real world implications today.
Right.
But there are ways for us to move forward together. And so let's look at what that looks like while acknowledging that that history is still there.
Right.
You know, you were talking about having your school bring you down to Pennsylvania to do this training. And I was thinking about it in context of all of the teachers that I know who are struggling for resources and struggling to get even the proper ratios of students in classrooms. For teachers out there who are being told they have to stick to a specific structure, how do they weave in some of this social justice curriculum into their work?
So, yes, I think it's everything depends on your setting, right? I was fortunate enough to be in a setting where I was being able to like not only develop my position, right? Like the fact that I could even develop that position and like have it be my job was great, but to also be able to incorporate a lot of like the culturally responsive and social justice sort of themes into my, into what I was teaching, was also very unique. I mean, there were people that would come and like observe me and just be like, but how do I do this at my school? Right. And I think that when you can back it up and say, listen, like all of these lessons that I'm teaching are actually aligned with like the standards. If you're able, like if you can do that, you could say, I'm still teaching, you know, the standards. I'm still teaching the curriculum that needs to be taught. However, it's being done in a way that is culturally responsive. It's being done in a way that's like applicable to our students so that they are better able to build bridges between school and home. Because you can teach a student math all you want, but if they don't necessarily understand like what is the real world implication of this, or how can I apply this to my home, or what's a practical application, like it's going to go in through one ear and out the other. It's not really learning, right? And so I think that there are ways for us to be able to frame this work in a way that it's like, this is important for many different reasons. It can still be aligned to the standards, right? We can still teach what needs to be taught in that sense, but it can be done in a way where it's just more applicable and in a way that's more engaging and more fun, right? That's how I would frame that, in the sense of like, you can still teach all of these different themes. You can still teach these subjects. It can be done in a way that's aligned and it's more engaging. And it's going to enrich not only your life as a teacher, but like their students' lives.
I'm having a hard time like really grasping what the difference between sort of anti-racism curriculum versus traditional quote unquote curriculum. Is there like a tangible sort of example that you can give of like how you have transformed what a traditional curriculum looks like versus a anti-racism curriculum?
So for instance, when you think of like speaking, they have like speaking and listening standards, right? Okay. When I was developing my curriculum, I sort of looked at those different standards and I thought like, okay, well, if a second grader needs to be able to, let's say, present in front of a classroom and have sort of evidence for it, whatever they're doing, and have to provide like a paragraph description, right? Like,
yeah.
There's like these lists of standards, right? So I would look at that and say like, okay, well, if that's at the end of the day, if that's the objective, if that's what they have to be able to do, how do we do that in a way where it's incorporating their culture or, you know, anti-racist work or things like that? And so for me, so my units were very much inspired by Bree Pickauer's 6 elements of social justice curriculum design for elementary students. And so I sort of picked 4 out of the 6 and I tied a unit to each of the elements. So the elements being self-love, love for others, social justice, and awareness raising. And so for self-love, I thought, well, okay, we have to start there, right? If you don't understand who you are, if you don't understand where you come from, what your passions are, if you don't have love, a deep understanding and a love for yourself, sure, it's going to be difficult for you to be able to love and respect other people. It's going to be difficult for you to understand and empathize and sympathize with folks who are being marginalized, right? Like things like that. And so we started there and then we moved into like, okay, well, what does it mean to respect people for their differences? A concrete example would be like, there are different family structures. In a traditional curriculum design, you constantly have like this idea that a family, what is a perfect family, right? Like the mother, the father, the 2 children, the dogs, the white picket fence, right? Like we have these traditions of what makes a quote unquote perfect family. And people would, they would ask a kindergartner, let's say, like, well, who's in your family? Or, you know, what's something that you like doing with your family or things like that, right? Not really breaking down the fact that there are many different family structures and normalizing that, right? So for instance, in my class, we would complicate that. We would read a book like The Great Big Book of Families, which actually shows you an entire, like a myriad, myriad of like family structures. It would be like, some kids have 2 mommies, or some kids have a mom and a dad, or some kids actually live with their grandma and grandpa, right? Like literally just showing and normalizing the fact that there's many different family structures, right? And then we discuss like, so what makes a family? Right? Because people have such different ideas of like, what makes a family? Do you have to be related by blood? Right? Like what is sort of like complicating it by just asking questions, really? Right? Sure. And then you have students do a project on it and then present on it. You're still hitting all of the same objectives. You're presenting, yeah. You're speaking to a group, you're able to describe it, you have evidence for it, right? Like all of these different standards that are still being hit, but in a way that it goes deeper, right? We go deeper mm-hmm. into each of these sort of things that make you who you are as a person, identity. Like that was one of the first words I introduced my students to, like identity. And we talked about what that is. And then we sort of went through different identity markers, what makes us who we are. And then we talked about like different social justice issues and how we talked about race and the difference between race and ethnicity and skin color, which got very complicated.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, yeah.
But, you know, it's complicated for adults.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's complicated for adults. But they were just so curious and they were just like, oh, wait, yeah, this is so interesting, right? Like how right. you can actually in one country, because I had a lot of students that came from Dominican Republic, how you can be seen at a certain way in Dominican Republic, right? But then you come here to the United States and you're seen as something else, mm-hmm. right? Like white in the Dominican Republic, and then you come to the United States and you're brown, right? Seen as something else. And so having all of those discussions was sort of just like the way that we moved and navigated through these topics. It was like through talking, like having circles, literally sitting in a circle and having, you know, one or two questions that we would just discuss. And then kids would, you know, then go home and talk to their parents and be like, oh, I learned about, you know, the Taínos and like how, you know, we shouldn't really celebrate Christopher Columbus because he like colonized us, you know, and like having sure. these conversations with their parents. And then they would come back and talk about it and be like, my mom said this. And, you know, they would bring articles and they'd be like, can we get into a circle and talk about this, you know?
Thank God, that's amazing.
I mean, it really was. I learned so much from them. I think I learned more from them than they did from me. Like,
You got tiny little curious minds who don't, you know, you're trying to shape them and to be good humans, and they have a lot of questions, and because they don't have the same sort of status quo or stereotypes or just sort of formation of ideas, and filters of what the world is, and that's a helpful way of looking at it, because I think what I needed to separate was. School standards or curriculum is probably like, you need to teach them reading comprehension, but right. they're not telling you how to teach them reading comprehension. It's just that you need to have reading comprehension so they can pass this test. And so you can then make those topics on things that are social justice, anti-racism, which I think makes a lot of sense. I wonder how, when you started doing this, the parents mm-hmm. took to it, because you know, we said, you're talking about race, you're talking about skin color. It got complex. And Gabby even said, as adults, like, this is a complex topic. So how can children take this? So what was sort of the reaction to that? Or what might you say to people who are saying that, like, these types of topics are too advanced mm-hmm. for elementary school children?
So I think what really helped me was that I had put in a lot of work, right? I had been at the school already for 5 years, and I had put in a lot of work to build relationships with all of our families, right? Not just like when I was teaching kindergarten, it wasn't just relationship building with like my students' families, but with everyone, right? Because we had, you know, community shows, and we had different events where we would see families, and sometimes, you know, we would be like greeters at the door, or like on the steps. We had like a system, right? And so mm-hmm. we would just like constantly trying to build relationships with families, I think is what really helped me, because I didn't have a single parent tell me like that they did not appreciate my curriculum.
That's
like
great.
Every single parent that I interacted with, like they would come to me and they would be like, I can't believe that this is being taught. Like, this is so cool that this is like something that you're teaching, that like, this is so valuable. We had like an entire PD for families on it. And they were just like, this is so great that our students get the privilege to be able to speak about these things. And at the time, right? I mean, you have to think about it. Donald Trump had just become the president, right? My students were distraught. I mean, I had students who came to school crying, bawling, in tears. I had students whose families were being told, like, you don't belong here on the bus. I had students, right? Like, literally, there was this atmosphere of, like, of fear and hatred and othering. And, like, so our families, when they were sort of learning that we were talking about these issues at school, like, they were kind of like, oh, wow, thank you, because I didn't know how to have this conversation with my child.
Yeah. Right?
Like the fact that you can have this conversation is great, because then I know what else to, you know, kind of like what else to talk about, or how to navigate the discussion, or like, you know, or they're just able to, you know, lead the conversation because they've already been learning about it at school.
Yeah. I'm so thankful that you took this initiative to not only teach this in the classroom, but also to start your own specific role to be able to build a whole curriculum around it. I really wish I had a teacher that could have woven this in when I was in second grade. You know, like it took us until high school to really truly talk about this in a meaningful way. And then it was because we were proactive and went and sought it out, right? Like it wasn't because the teacher really brought it to us. Mm-hmm. So I think it's incredibly meaningful, especially like you're saying right now, in an atmosphere where tension has been building and there is a lot more unfiltered isms out in the world, where a lot before there was a lot of shame. So people might have had those thoughts and ideas in their heads, but wouldn't speak them out loud. Now there's really no shame to speak them out loud. And that makes it a lot harder for people to, you know, feel like they can be safe in their everyday lives when they are a minority in any way, shape, or form. So I'm wondering, in the instances where you were bringing this into the classroom, bringing this into your school curriculum and to your school environment, how did other fellow teachers and administrators react? And how were they able to support you in the way that you were bringing that to the community?
Yeah, so part of my role as a school culture coach was actually to observe teachers and sort of give them feedback on how they were doing with in terms of like their classroom culture, in terms of, you know, trying to implement some of this in their classroom, have these discussions in their classroom and things like that. And so that was like part of my role. So I was able to go into classrooms and really sort of like collaborate with the teachers and be like, hey, so in terms of like your classroom culture, like what do you want it to look like? What do you want it to feel like here? Right. How are you sort of making sure that your everything that's, you know, when you think about lessons, when you think about the books that you're displaying, when you think about the posters you're putting up, like what are the messages you're trying to send to our students? Right. And I think that we sort of thinking about like just across, like just what are the values, right, that we really want to share and sort of expose our students to. And, you know, we would think about that. We would think through them. And then we would sort of, they would say like, oh, you know, I'm teaching this lesson in a few days. Like, and we would review it and be like, okay, well, how can we make this more culturally responsive or more engaging, right? Or how can we make it so that there's a sort of more, a clearer bridge between like home and school, right? Mm-hmm. And so we had that relationship. That was like a part of my role, which was great. And then obviously as like the social action teacher, I'd be like, hey, we're doing this read aloud in my classroom. Like, how is there any space or time in your classroom where you can like further develop this idea? Or what are you reading in your classroom and like that I can then take back into my classroom, right? So there was a sense of like interconnectedness. There was a sense of like, okay, well, students know that whatever they're learning in their classroom, like they can talk about it in my classroom or vice versa, right? It's not just in my room. It's not just something that's happening in my room, but it's something that's spreading throughout. And so also as a school culture coach, I was like in charge of our morning meetings. As a school, we had like a weekly festival, like on Fridays, where we would have like shows and students will dance and sing and do different things, but we would make it themed. So we had like Latinx Heritage Month, like Women's History Month, like all of these things where we would be very intentional about like, okay, well, we're going to have these discussions, even if we're celebrating and, you know, enjoying ourselves, but we're also going to have these discussions around like gender and race and like, you know, different things like that in our culture. So
I can imagine that was a really amazing community that you were in, because it just sounds like your elementary school was so different than mine.
Yeah, no kidding.
But it's, you know, I guess my gut reaction is as somebody who is a person of color, marginalized, I'm immigrant, as a peer educator, I would be so on board for it. And I'm wondering did you get any pushback from anyone, or maybe even silence, like lack of support, not necessarily like direct challenge to what you were doing, but just not really being on board?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely had some resistance from some teachers. Not really like outwardly resistance, but you can tell even in their body, like when we would have certain discussions, that they just felt very uncomfortable having these discussions or like teaching students about when we think about like slavery or we think about, and like we think about like oppression and all of that. There were some teachers who were just like, I don't know. And particularly white teachers would be like, I'm not really sure how to do this. Or and like, because they didn't know, they felt like they were sort of absolved. Like they didn't have to do the work. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. They would kind of like lean on folks of color and then kind of expect for them to sort of teach them or to just take it on. Right. And so that was a bit of a problem. And I had to have some very frank conversations with people around like, why are you uncomfortable? Like, what is making you uncomfortable? Right. Like, and how can we overcome that? Because at the end of the day, like, we have to make sure that we're doing right by our students. Right. It's not a personal thing. Like, it's something that it has to go beyond just a personal thing. Right. Like, we are teachers. This is our job. Right? We have to make sure that we're teaching them the truth. We have to make sure that we're not sugarcoating things. Objectivity and neutrality is actually a tenet of white supremacy, and we cannot be neutral, right? So we have to make sure that we are not telling our students what to think, but we have to teach them how to think, right? We have to teach them to be critical thinkers. And so how do we do that, right? And these conversations, sometimes they went really well, and other times they were just kind of, they fell flat. They fell on deaf ears, right? It was difficult. It was interesting. When you call on people, right? Because you can call out the system and people are like, yes, white supremacy, this system. But the minute you start to call out or even call in people and how they're maintaining these systems, then it becomes a problem. So I ended up actually leaving my school because my principal couldn't handle it. Because I told her she needed to review her hiring practices, given the fact that 95% of the new administration, like people in leadership, were going to be white. And also the fact that a lot of the other positions, kind of like managerial positions, things like that, were also given to white folks when there were very well, like candidates of color who could have very well done that, those positions, right? Like all of the pathways to leadership were primarily given to white folks. So when you start to call people out on their shit, then that's when you're like, oh, you're too radical, right? They start to push you out. They start to critique you. They start to threaten. Oh, well, maybe you shouldn't do this next year. This position isn't for you.
When we talk about diversity, we also need to talk about representation. Think about your favorite movies, TV shows, and even magazines. Do you feel fully represented, seen for all of your intersectional identities? I often don't. But I finally found one that does. Be Latina magazine is the one for me. It showcases inspirational women through a distinctive combination of diversity, intelligence, and authentic voices underscored by ambitious journalism. If you're ready for a magazine that represents all Latinas, visit BeLatina.com today.
So when you first started talking about how some people weren't getting on board with it right away, and it was mainly the white teachers, I immediately was like, it's probably the white teachers, and it's probably because they feel like they don't know how to talk about it, and that they feel like they're going to say the wrong thing, or like this fear that like they will come across as racist because they don't actually feel like they are confident in knowing what they're talking about. So I think that there's two sides. It's the, what resources do white teachers need so that way they can actually teach this and feel confident in it? And then what can white teachers who want it actually be a good ally? What do they need to do?
Yep. So here's the thing. White teachers who were resistant at my school, do some of this work, they were given resources. They were given opportunities to come to book clubs, to come to sort of events that we were having. We were having moving screenings, talk about these things at the end, and they wouldn't show up. They weren't showing up, right? And so here's the thing. You need to be ready to do this work.
Yeah.
You can get all the resources you want. You can read all the books that you want, or you can be given, I'm saying, these resources. But if you're not ready to really confront racism and to really confront your racism, it's going to be difficult. Like, if you're not ready.
Yeah,
and
that's very fair.
Right. So I think it needs to start there. You need to sort of just stop and reflect and be like, okay, why am I struggling with this? What makes me feel uncomfortable, right? Like, you have to take inventory of who you are as a person, of where you're at in this sort of trajectory, and be like, okay, I'm not actually ready to confront this. Or if you are, and be like, you know, at least I'm open to it.
Right.
And that's where you need to start, right? You need to start with confronting your racism, sitting with it, reflecting on your power, reflecting on your privilege, reflecting on, you know, healing. Just like, what does healing look like for me as a white person, right? You need to understand that you need to sit down and be like, hey, my ancestors, like, they did some messed up things. And I need to work through that. And there are ways to move forward without sort of repressing that or without rejecting it, mm-hmm. right? And so active, it's a lifelong process of you actively having to, you know, be like anti-racist, right? It's not going to be easy. It's not something that's going to happen in a year or two or, right? Like, it's a lifelong sort of learning process of like unlearning, right? Doing a lot of unlearning.
Yeah.
And then really starting to think about, okay, well, what if I am a teacher, right? If I'm an educator and I'm mostly educating Black and Brown folks, mm-hmm. right? Like Black and Brown students, like, what does it look like for me to be an ally in this work, right? And what does it look like for me to really look at our policies and our practices and to think about, like, what is racist about this, right? Or like, what about this makes me feel really comfortable? Why? And then what about this makes me feel uncomfortable? Why? Right? I think it's that work needs to start there. And then when you are, you know, when you are open and you are ready, like, the books, the resources, it won't necessarily come from other people. It'll come from you because you want to learn, right? And so you will go out there and do the research. And there's plenty of resources out there to do this work, right? You don't have to rely on folks of color just to be able to, right? And so once that happens, and I think you're sort of feeling better about that, or you're feeling okay with being uncomfortable.
Yes.
Right. Once mm-hmm. you're okay with being uncomfortable, then you can start to, I think, start to collaborate and think of yourself as like, okay, well, how do I become then an ally to sort of the Black and Indigenous people of color in my workplace? Right. Like, how can I help move this work forward, and how can I be an ally to them? And I think it starts with, like, white folks have to believe and trust people of color.
Yeah.
You have to believe them. You have to just trust that what they are saying is not a personal judgment or an attack, but it's like, it's true, right? Mm-hmm. Accept it. Accept that it's true. Support their work emotionally, professionally, right? It takes building deep relationships with folks, which can be difficult. Mm-hmm. But you have to back them up. If you're at a meeting and somebody, a person of color, is saying that something is, you know, maybe it's, you know, it's just, it's racist, or it's disproportionately affecting students, like, then talk to them and after, or, you know, be like, hey, how can I best support you in the next meeting? Or, I thought you made some really good points. Like, how can I then in the meeting, sort of be an ally to you? Does that mean that I should sort of bring up that point because you think as a white person I'll be heard more? Or does that mean that I should, like, piggyback off your point and say, hey, I think this point that X, Y, and Z just made, I think that I really think we should do something about that. I also see it as a problem, right? It's not just a matter of at the end being like, hey, good point. Thank you for raising that. You need to show administration, right, and the folks with power that you're also on board, right, that you also find these policies and practices problematic. I think that white folks need to call out admin when they're being racist. You have to hold them accountable. They have to hold other educators accountable when they're not doing the work, right? And I think at the end of the day, they always have to follow the lead of those who are most impacted by oppression.
I think it's really important. And I could see sort of in your situation where you're coming in and you're really changing what the school's doing for that resistance, but it's so, like, even just getting a foundation, like knowing that you're going to get that pushback and then slowly being able to make more impactful change over time as you get new people coming in who are on board with that type of curriculum that you're trying to teach and things like that. So I think that that's really interesting. And I agree with you that it really comes down to, in all of these conversations that we've been having, as we're talking about mainly, how do white individuals be better allies? It comes down to, you got to be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I just particularly love that this theme has really evolved over the course of our podcast so far, is that people really like to be asked how they want folks who are in a position of power to support them, right? And it's so much more important than to make an assumption about how a white person in the room thinks that they should be supportive, like coming at after a meeting and saying like, that was a really good point, I really appreciate that you rose that, you know, but knowing that you can ask the question, how can I be an ally to you next time when those conversations happen, so that they can then react in the way that is most supportive to you in that space. Because otherwise, they're going to make an assumption and they could be wrong. They could actually put their foot in their mouth, or they could actually minimize what you were saying. Like if they think, oh, I'm going to use my power next time to speak up and make sure that my voice is heard so that it's clear that that's not okay, even though Kathy said it last time, right? Like that could potentially put you in a position where you feel small rather than empowered. So Asking the question, I think, is the most important thing. If you want to be a good ally, saying like, how can I be supportive of you?
Yeah. And the mirroring that you were sort of saying, where maybe one person brings up a point and then the other person says, yes, I also agree with that. So how can we talk about that more? That's actually a practice that I know a lot of people at my office do, where there's a group of women who tend to be quieter, not heard quite as much, not taken as seriously. And so even when they're in times of, I don't necessarily agree with my fellow woman's point, but it's my duty as also a woman in the room to help them and move them forward. So they'll echo each other. Mm. And they go in with this mindset of talking about it. That's like, okay, like I don't 100% agree with you, but I know that this is important to you. And so my responsibility to you, as you would do the same to me, is to help you. And so in the meeting, they echo each other to make themselves louder.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's unfortunate that we even have to do that, right? That,
yeah.
right? It's so frustrating, but that is a strategy, right? That is a strategy at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It sounds like you gave us some really good tangible ways to start weaving in some of this social justice centered work into the curriculum and into your community. Are there any other ways that you would recommend to someone if they wanted to help educators in general or their education space to start increasing equality in a K-12 environment?
Yeah, there's so many ways. Anything from creating a book club, right? And I'm thinking of like, okay, you pick a book, White Fragility, right? It could be for white folks who teach in the hood and the rest of y'all too, by Chris Emden. I mean, there's so many books out there that you could start with and just like have a group of educators sit down with you and do a book club, reflect on these questions, right? You could start a committee. You can think about, you know, your curriculum and have frank discussions around like, what is up with our curriculum? Is our curriculum racist in any way? You know, what can we do about that? How can we change it? How can we make it more culturally responsive? How can we make it anti-racist? Could you start doing healing work, like thinking about healing and having these conversations, like not just interpersonally, right? But like as a community, what does healing look like for us? I think seeking out support, like for instance, I'm you know, an equity consultant and a school and a coach. And so for me, you know, when I get called on to come and work with organizations or schools, I see how some of the, you know, through these workshops, like ideas spark and then people are like, oh, we can do this. Right. And then they start to think about like, who are the people in the room that they can start doing this work with? And, you know, they start implementing things. So I think sometimes you need outside people to come in and to sort of like help you see like how you can actually put this into practice. It's not just about the theory, but the practice, right? Like, how do we actually tangibly, how do we put this into practice? But those are just a few of the ways that you can begin to do this work.
Yeah, they're phenomenal. So I know that this is now something that you're doing full time, right?
I'm the founder of the Radical Maestra. And that was just sort of when I thought like, I can't just do this work in one classroom or like in one school. Like this work is so important. And I've heard it from our families. I've heard it from our students that it needs to go just beyond, right? Just being at a school or just being at one school. And so I started consulting and doing workshops and providing, you know, professional development through the Radical Maestra. And also, you know, I started this, the online platform, like you can visit the website, and on the website, you know, there's so many resources and things like that. And so I'm not actually doing that work full time because I'm a communications director at a foundation called Resist. But the hope is that in a few years, I'll actually start my own micro school that will be like an anti-racist, culturally responsive, like radical school for liberation. So that is the goal, that in hopefully 4 to 5 years, I'll be starting a school where folks can come and see how we're unschooling our kids.
Yes. Ooh, unschooling. What a good way to put that. I love that so much.
I love it. I wanted to snap at everything that you've been saying all this time.
You've been resisting so hard.
I've been resisting the snap because then it would pop the mic and we wouldn't be able to hear the amazing things that you're saying that make me want to snap. So it sounds like you have some amazing long-term goals. Do you have any short-term things that you're working on that you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah. So, I mean, besides still doing consulting with the Radical Maestra, as I said, I am a mother to be. And so one of my projects right now is called Reimagining Motherhood, and sort of breaking down, like, what does it look like to parent for liberation? Like, what does that mean? What does that look like? And I think a lot of it is breaking down, I mean, thinking about patriarchy, thinking about gender, thinking about sort of traditional roles and how women or folks who are giving birth, how they're often, like, their entire identity revolves around motherhood, right? And how do we break that? How do we define motherhood and how do we disrupt it? And so I started this Instagram series on my personal Instagram. So my personal Instagram is Kathy_and_Eric. That's my fiance's name. And we started this Motherhood Mondays series. So on Mondays, we sort of have these sort of different discussions around parenting and motherhood and what that could look like. And so that's one of my more recent projects.
I love that. I think that's so cool. Also, like, so necessary, especially in, like, traditional women of color communities. I feel like there's so many more ideas about what womanhood looks like, what motherhood looks like, and how to parent. And I specifically, now that we're of the age that all of our friends are starting to have babies, I'm starting to think about, like, okay, what does it look like to still keep your identity? And also, when you bring up your kids, you're the primary example that you have in the household of how to create behavior. So mothers have a really key role when it comes to thinking about things like social justice and anti-racism. We have a responsibility to teach our kids to think about the world in a way where it's empathetic and it's thoughtful about what's going on, and teach critical thinking in your household beyond just the classroom. So I think that's incredible. You're doing some badass shit. I am so, so thankful that I know you. It's so cool.
Gabby's like beaming with Smithy pride.
I am.
I love it.
I also wanted to say, so Gabby and I, like, we want to have children and we're trying to plan that. And obviously with two women, it's a little bit more complicated.
Yes.
But, you know, we go back and forth a lot of, do we want to bring somebody in the world when the world seems to be falling apart?
Yeah. When the world is burning, literally and figuratively.
Literally the world is burning. Mm-hmm. But I will say, you know, one of the things that Gabby really says, which I really love, and you can talk about more, is, like, children are hope. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, children are hope, not only for them growing up and maybe changing and saving the world, but also drivers of us wanting to make change because we want to make the world a better place for them.
Yeah. I need an outside source outside of myself to know that I'm creating change for them, right? Like, if there are children in the world, I know that we need to make the world better because we're going to leave it behind for them.
Yeah.
I don't like the idea that we have to leave it behind, the mess behind, for them to fix.
Yeah.
Right? And so... Yeah. Knowing that we're going to have a new generation of kids gives me hope because it gives me an inspiration to want to fight harder to ensure that they live in a world that is fair and just and not run by Donald Trump.
And here's the thing. I mean, my friend and coworker, Kendra Hicks, she talks a lot about this, about, like, how we've been here before. The apocalypse has happened many times before. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, it's not actually the end of the world, right? Like, we have been here. People have been able to rise from the ashes and create new things all the time and move forward and heal. And so I used to think that way. I used to think that way. And I would tell, you know, my partner, I'm like, I don't think I want any kids like in this world. Like, why, how, why would I do that to my children? And it, at the same time, it's like, yes, because we owe it to them. We have to change, not just for our children, but for seven generations forward, as they say, right? Like, we owe it to them for us to be able to do this work and then pass that down to them so that, you know, it can only get better. I mean, and hopefully it will only get better, right?
I love you. And listening to people like you and all the other people that we've been having on our podcast is really, like, it's just like a good soul feeder for me to remember that, like, yes, there's bad stuff going on in the world, but we have so many people who are want the world to be better and to grow and to fight the good fight and all of this stuff. And so I feel like every time we get to talk to people and people like you who are just doing badass shit, like, it feels so good to just be like, no, like, yeah, we got a lot of work we have to do, but it's going to be okay. Like, we got people doing good things, like, getting on our side. Like, we're trying to do the best that we can to, like, make people think harder about what they're saying and what they're doing. Like, it's going to be okay.
Yeah, you give me help, girl. Like, it's going to be fine.
It's going to be fine. It's going to be okay.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. I know this has been, for me, it's been a very wonderful conversation because it just reminds me of all the small things, the tangible things that we can do to just weave in these conversations in our everyday work, no matter what it is. And I think education is one of those primary examples where it feels like there are a lot of structures and rules and maybe even barriers to the way that we can teach in our current system, but there's always a way to weave in and apply a new lens to the work that we're doing to help train our young ones. And it doesn't matter whether they're in second grade or 12th grade, there are different ways to help them think about the world differently. And I really appreciate the folks who are like you doing that kind of work.
Thank you all so much. Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
I think everyone deserves a teacher who is this incredibly thoughtful about this topic.
I agree. I look at this as a lot of the conversations that we've been having are how do we as adults unlearn a lot of what we've learned, right? Like, how do we change what we know and what we grew up in, right? This is literally the prevention of having to have those types of conversations, right? Like, if we want to have an inclusive workspace, well, you start at education, you start teaching children young to be thoughtful about these things, then you're already half the battle by the time that they're in the workplace.
Yeah.
Right? Like, not that they're not going to learn sort of certain things as they grow up, right? But if we can teach them to understand what it means to be a good person and what it means to be an ally at a young age, we're not going to have to reteach those things when they grow up.
Totally agree. I think this is really cool.
Yeah.
This episode was written and produced by me, Gabby Acosta, and co-hosted by
me, Janelle Acosta.
Our music was written and produced by Emily Henry. And I highly encourage y'all to stop by our website, take a look at our episode notes. Kathy has some amazing resources. We love to hear from you guys. Send us your messages about what made you feel something in this episode or any previous episode. Have questions or topics for future episodes. We want to hear them. Subscribe to our newsletter on our website because that's where you're going to get the bulk of our content. Here's Janelle singing us out with this week's Seed Fund sponsors.
Rahana, Mohammed, and Tierna Singh, Stacy, Mama Coase, and Sue Whiteoff, Susanna Vaughn, and Thelma Andre. Every time.